The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 2002, I did my only interview with Russell Martin. Russell is known for his literary nonfiction, for his fiction, and as a documentary filmmaker. And at the time he visited the program in 2002, we were talking about a new book called Picasso's War. We looked back at 1937 and the Spanish Civil War, which was a prelude to World War II. If you're not familiar with the history, Spain had relatively recently become a democracy in the mid-1930s. And then Generalissimo Francisco Franco decided he wanted to do something about that. And with the assistance of the fascist regime in Italy under Benito Mussolini and the Nazis in Germany under Adolf Hitler, they got to practice for World War II by bombing Spain in support of the fascist Franco. And Pablo Picasso is a part of this story. Let's listen now. As we talked about Picasso's War, Russell Martin and me, back in 2002.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today my guest is Russell Martin. His book is Picasso's War, The Destruction of Guernica and the Masterpiece That Changed the World. He joins us by telephone from what I'm guessing is probably snowy Utah.
Snowy Salt Lake City. It's very snowy here.
How are you, Russell?
I'm just fine, thank you, Vic.
Russell, I've never had you on the program before, and I was reading your bibliography here, and I said to myself, how did I miss this guy? You've written a number of very interesting books.
You know, those books are out there, and they love having readers come along, and that's kind of you to say so, sure.
So give us a little background. Tell us about some of these other books before we get into the new one. Tell us about yourself, how you got into this writing game.
I started to write when I was a kid and had the great good fortune of having teachers tell me I was doing a good job with it. And as you know, there's nothing like encouragement in this world. For me, it's always been a difficult undertaking, but one that challenge appeals to me, and I've taken it on. And I've had the good fortune to discover early on. I'm age 50 now. Just middle age. I have to remind my daughter that I'm just barely in middle age. And early on, I had the good fortune to discover that I could write as creatively as I wanted out of reportage as well as out of imagination. I have one published novel, Beautiful Islands, that was published in the late 80s. I've written another novel that is yet to be published. But most of my work is nonfiction. And it's in this genre that now is commonly referred to as creative nonfiction or literary journalism, a kind of writing in which you bring the tools of a novelist to nonfiction subjects. Those subjects for me have ranged from history, the building of Glen Canyon Dam on the Colorado River and its role in creating the modern environmental movement. A book of mine called Matters Gray and White is a profile of a neurologist and his patients and a look at the brain's, the wonder and sometimes the misfunctioning of the brain. Prior to Picasso's War, I wrote a book called Beethoven's Hair, which is a chronicling of a lock of hair that was cut from Beethoven's corpse on his deathbed in 1827 and that has had a remarkable trip through time. It was purchased in 1995 by a couple of Beethoven nuts, they don't mind being called that, Beethoven enthusiasts in Arizona who succeeded in fulfilling Beethoven's wish that sometime after his death, the explanation for his terrible health and suffering and of course his deafness might be explained. Those men succeeded in that regard with the help of internationally eminent forensic scientists, and they were able to prove that Beethoven was massively toxic with lead at his death and probably had been poisoned by lead throughout much of his adult life.
Were they able to clone him?
There is no cloning so far.
Well, I know, Russell, just about every time I see your name mentioned, they always say, the author of Beethoven's Hair, like, this was a big book for you.
It was a big book. It was a wonderful project, an unlikely kind of thing to take up. One doesn't get the opportunity very often to write books that are both historical and contemporary at the same time, and that was both a challenge and a real thrill.
My guest is Russell Martin. Russell, many of us remember what we were doing on the day John F. Kennedy was shot. I think all of us remember exactly what we were doing on September 11, 2001. What were you doing?
Curiously enough, I was in Madrid and was in the midst of a research trip for Picasso's War, the new book, a book that was a year underway at that point. I had become familiar with the painting Guernica 30 years before, but had never seen it. We spent a week in Madrid, and each of those days we were at the Reina Sofia, the Contemporary Art Museum in Madrid, where Guernica has been exhibited for the last decade. September 11th was our last day at the museum, and when we left, sadly, people hearing us speak said, "You sound as if you're American," and we said, "Yes, we are," and they said, "Well, you should go find a television because something rather unbelievable is going on in the United States." And of course, we soon found out that they were all too correct in saying so.
This story of your connection to this painting really begins in high school for you, doesn't it?
It began with the wonderful good fortune I had to go to Spain as a high school junior in a school year abroad program. I lived in Barcelona, and my most important teacher then, and perhaps the most important teacher in my life, and I've been blessed with lots of wonderful teachers over the years, is a man named Angel Villalta, who was a Spanish art and culture professor who wanted his American students to get to know El Guernica, the painting, in the context of the bombing of the town of Guernica, the Basque town of Guernica, in the Spanish Civil War. He understood, of course, that we likely knew very little about the Spanish Civil War, and his own experiences, he was age 10 at the time the war began, allowed him to make the war vivid and horrifying in our eyes. And that was our introduction to the painting that, of course, was Picasso's own impassioned response to the bombing of the painting. So unlike lots of American people my age who got to know Guernica as, curiously, as a symbol in opposition to the Vietnam War, for instance, the painting for me was first emblematic of what had happened, the horror that occurred in this particular Basque town, and the tragedy that Spain had fallen to the fascists in the years prior to World War II.
I can remember I was a big history nut in school, but it seemed that the Spanish Civil War was always treated as sort of a footnote, a prelude to World War II. It was sort of a test run for the Nazi war regime. I didn't comprehend until I read your book, Picasso's War, what all the particulars were. For instance, this town. I had no idea of the significance of this particular town.
The Basques have been semi-independent and have longed for greater independence from Spain for centuries. They are a wonderfully proud and accomplished people. The small town of Guernica, which had about 7,000 people in it in 1937 when it was bombed, now has about 12,000 people, has been the seat of Basque democracy for a very long time. An assembly hall was built many centuries ago, but beside a revered oak tree that now has that oak tree's children, in effect, now survive and are carefully tended to in the setting, in the gorgeous mountain setting of the town of Guernica. Spanish kings, as well as Basque leaders, have journeyed to Guernica for as long as people remember, to guarantee independence and a variety of rights to the Basque people. They've done so in the town of Guernica, and it was no coincidence, of course, that was the town that the insurgent Spanish general Francisco Franco, in consultation with the German Luftwaffe, who had come to Spain to fight against the democratically elected government on Franco's behalf, had chosen as a symbolic target. It was critically important midway through the Spanish Civil War for those insurgents in opposition to the Republican government to win control of the Basque region. It was vitally important, in particular the port city of Bilbao, which was far and away Spain's most important industrial city. But taking Bilbao would have been an enormous undertaking, absent a loss of resolve on the part of the Basques. The decision was made very clearly to destroy the town of Guernica in hopes that the citizens of the Basque region would be cowed by that destruction and that the citizens of Bilbao in particular would opt to surrender rather than to fight.
You are listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO at 91.3 on your dial, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. Looking back at 2002, an interview I did with Russell Martin talking about Pablo Picasso and a masterpiece he painted during the Spanish Civil War. We'll bring you more of this conversation right after this. The best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. And this interview from 2002 is one of those timeless ones. It could have been recorded yesterday. We were talking about the Spanish Civil War on the best of the Book Nook.
My guest is Russell Martin. The book is Picasso's War, The Destruction of Guernica, and the Masterpiece That Changed the World. Before we get into the particulars, which you detail so graphically about what happened to this little town, let's talk about this guy, Pablo Ruiz. What a guy.
Yes. Like many important figures in history, a very small man who, in stature, who was far larger than life in so many ways.
What about him? Tell us about this guy.
Pablo Ruiz, who assumed his mother's maiden name, Picasso, when he became a young adult, was born in Malaga on the southern coast of Spain. Grew up in Barcelona, and Barcelona was a wonderfully lively place during his childhood and the years in which he emerged as a painter. His father, an art instructor, was so astounded by his son's artistic abilities early on that he gave up his own painting. He believed that his son's talent was such that he really couldn't somehow stand the comparison. There was no friction there. His father was hugely proud of him. But Picasso was someone who, it's curious, like Beethoven, had an uncanny sense of his own capabilities, his own ability to create paintings, to create art that mattered. It's something that made him a complex human being. He was far from the easiest person to be around. His temperament was mercurial. He could be viciously cruel and sadly, in particular, to family members. He was a famously poor father and grandfather. Yet his friends adored him, and he was a wonderful person in whose presence people spent time. And he was a person who virtually always was creating, whether he had a paintbrush in his hand or was tearing pieces of paper as he sat in cafes, scribbling on those pieces of paper, finding junk in alleyways that he turned effortlessly into works of art. He was someone who was a perhaps the quintessential visual creator of the last several centuries, and without question is revered as the foremost painter of the 20th century.
He never threw anything away, did he? And he always dated things.
It was curious that he had part of his sense of the importance of his work and his own self importance was manifested in his carefully inscribing the date on everything he did. Even the simplest drawings on napkins have a date on them.
Andy Warhol was an accumulator like that, but they certainly, I don't think, are very comparable as far as their talent. Picasso, you talk about him being paid for the painting by the Spanish government, and it was the equivalent of $6,000. At this time, he was the most famous painter in the world. He had never received so much money for one of his paintings. Of course, he hoarded his paintings. He had hundreds of paintings stashed away. Can you imagine what he would think of the prices for art these days?
No, there's been a bit of inflation along those lines, of course, you know, his children and grandchildren have been the beneficiaries of that inflation. But it is astonishing. I wish I had a number for you, but the extant pieces of art, the physical pieces of art that can be held on in one's hands or that hang on walls throughout the world, number in the many, many thousands.
That he did.
Yes.
Well, he was definitely prolific, and when this happened, this event in Spain, he had been living in France for many years. He still considered himself a Spaniard, and you try to reconstruct how he might have heard about this horrible, horrible blitzkrieg attack on this innocent little village. You go back to the newspapers of the time, and you speculate which ones he might have looked at and how he might have heard the news. And before this even happened, he had been approached to create a giant painting. Give us some background.
Picasso had lived in Paris since 1904. Paris clearly was the artistic epicenter of the world, and it was a place where he felt he really needed and wanted to be. Yet his sense of his Spanishness, he was a proud Spanish patriot, and he, like most Spanish artists and intellectuals who lived outside the country, was enormously cheered by the emergence of Spanish democracy in 1932. It was something that meant an enormous amount to him, and the democracy's being threatened by the revolt of Francisco Franco and his fellow insurgent generals was something that Picasso had been deeply disturbed by. He attempted to do what little he could by way of sending money to the Republican cause to support friends inside Spain, and he had agreed in January of 1937 to at least give real consideration to the creation of a big mural for the Spanish pavilion at the planned Paris World's Fair scheduled to open in the summer of 1937. He was clearly not a poster artist. In fact, he went out of his way not to agree to create propagandistic art. It was something that he clearly felt a bit above. Yet he desperately wanted to do what he could for the Spanish Republic. And when the Spanish ambassador and the architect designing the Spanish pavilion came to see him in January, he was receptive, and they left with the sense that Picasso probably would help them, would create a mural, but they couldn't be sure. For the months that followed, Picasso worked only in the sense that he tried to come up with an idea for the large mural. It's a measure of who he was that the best idea he had come up with in the spring of that year was a painting that he planned to call The Studio. And it was a painting about an artist at work in his studio, an artist much like Picasso. You know, he was without question was a very self-focused human being. But when on April 26, 1937, the town of Guernica was utterly destroyed by German bombers, and the news of that destruction reached Paris, Picasso instantly finally had the subject matter that that would spur him to work, and that he believed would rightly and with great eloquence hang on the wall in the Spanish Pavilion as a way of pointing out to people around the world the horror that was underway in Spain.
And the willful and totally over-the-top annihilation of Guernica by the Germans and by the Italians.
Both Hitler and Mussolini had answered the request of Franco to send troops, to send munitions, to send tanks. It's curious, and this is an important thing to mention, that in 1936, when the war broke out, in response to the fascist incursion into Spain, the Western democracies chose to do absolutely nothing. At the time, people were already very fearful of what was underway in Germany, and Hitler was very much feared throughout the world, and what Hitler had in mind was of great concern. Yet France, Great Britain, the United States, Canada, none of those countries opted in any way to come to Spain's aid. None of them offered financial aid, and that decision changed the shape of the rest of the 20th century. There can't be any question. Had fascism been halted in Spain, World War II almost certainly would not have occurred. Had fascism been checked, World War II would have had a very different length, almost certainly. And it's not outside the realm of discussion, certainly, to consider that if the United States and Great Britain and France had dramatically checked the advance of fascism in Spain, that the Holocaust might not have occurred. We of course can't say that that's the case, but it's a fascinating topic for discussion.
Oh, how we could speculate on that one. My guest is Russell Martin. His book is Picasso's War, The Destruction of Guernica and the Masterpiece That Changed the World. Throughout the course of our recorded history, we have so many examples of what I call the big lie. You know, things like Strom Thurmond would have been a great president. we did not bomb Guernica. I couldn't believe the equivocation that went on with Franco's people. Unbelievable that they could claim they didn't know anything about it, that the weather was bad, this never happened, the Reds did it.
And more than that, it was important to claim that the Basques had destroyed their own sacred town, that was evidence of how ruthless these Basque communists, and of course very few were communists, but from a fascistic right wing perspective, nothing on earth could be worse than godless communism, of course, at that time. And so for months and years, long after the Spanish Civil War, in fact, Franco and his colleagues were absolutely reluctant to claim any kind of responsibility for the bombing of Guernica. That the town was rebuilt by Franco in the 1940s, but there was never any acknowledgement that Franco had been complicit in its destruction.
Another thing that I think you did very well in the book was to give us the history of how this war started and what the government had been like in Spain during that period. This was a tumultuous period for Spain going into the ultimate victory by Franco's troops.
Without question, the democracy was just a few years old. It was fragile, made up of a coalition of political factions that were mistrustful of each other, that had different agendas, and it was almost certainly my reading of the history is that the Republic, the Spanish Republic, could have survived and would have survived the insurrection, except for the assistance that was very quickly offered by both Germany and Italy, and the absence of any kind of counter to that by the Western democracies. Virtually every historian who I've read makes it clear that had had there been a significant level of assistance coming from other Western democracies early in the war, that the generals would have been defeated very quickly. That didn't happen, of course. And at the end of the Spanish Civil War in 1939, Franco assumed massive power. And it was curious that as late as 1968, when I was living in Spain, when Spain remained an absolutely totalitarian place, I lived with a Spanish family, and one of their sons, who was a college age son, was the infamous Guardia Civil knocked on the door of the house where we lived one night and took him away. He didn't return for many days, and when he did, his head was shorn, and he had joined in quotation marks, the Spanish army as a means of ending the torture that was underway, as he was questioned with regard to his allegiances and alliances. His great crime had been participating in an unauthorized demonstration at the University of Barcelona. That was the kind of place Spain was when I lived there late in the 1960s. And people like Angel Villalta, my teacher, attempted to make it clear to us American kids that fascism had not been destroyed at the end of the Second World War, that it remained alive and sadly, tragically, very well into the 1970s.
Well, it's quite a story. It's Picasso's War. Russell Martin wrote it, and it's the destruction of Guernica and the masterpiece that changed the world. I was so amazed by the way you describe Picasso creating this painting. Okay, he's outraged. He's changed his mind about what he's going to put on this gigantic canvas, and you go detail by detail. I've always looked at this painting, and I've never really studied art history, so I had no clue what this represented, all these images. I didn't know what they meant. I could feel the feeling from it. I think most people can. But I didn't understand where Picasso was coming from. And you go through it bit by bit. Plus, he had one of his mistresses, Dora Maar, documenting it photographically. How did you get access to all this material, like his sketches?
Dora Maar's photographing of the painting and the stages at which it was created has been an absolute blessing to art historians, to Picasso historians in particular, because it very very seldom has any painting of this importance been documented in the context of the kind of changes that are made in the painting process, images that appear on canvas then disappear, that are changed, that are manipulated, that are obliterated. Those photographs matter enormously in the context of understanding the painting, as do the 60 sketches and sub-paintings that Picasso used as studies in the creation of the mural. He began, Guernica was destroyed on April 26th, as I mentioned. Picasso began the first sketches on May the 1st, less than a week later. He worked with passionate intensity. He was known to work late into the nights. In any case, he was renowned as a vibrant, possessed kind of painter. But he worked in a fashion on this massive mural, which is, by the way, more than 26 feet wide, over 11 feet high. It's absolutely enormous. So big that in his huge studio, it had to be tilted against the ceiling beams. He worked from ladders. He strapped brushes to sticks in order to reach the heights of the canvas. Worked on his knees, and he very quickly populated the canvas with images that didn't come specifically from the town of Guernica, but that came from his own Spanish iconography. The painting quickly was filled with images that from him were representative of Spain, first and foremost. And in that context, Picasso had long revered the images of the corrida, of the bullfight. And it's in retrospect, it makes a lot of sense to me that if as Picasso began to create a visual image of chaos and wanton terrible destruction in Spain, terrible violence in Spain, that the bullfight would come to his mind. The bullfight is something that Picasso had been fascinated with throughout his life. He remained fascinated with. But the bullfight is a dramatized reacting of a kind of living and dying pageant. It's certainly as much pageant and drama as it is sport. I think it's much more that. I think it's really not much of a sport at all. But in the bullfight, classically, a horse must die in order for the bull ultimately to be killed. So a horse, a wounded horse, a horse that has already fallen from his feet and is crying out in terrible pain, a horse that has been penetrated by a deep spear, is the central image in the painting, which I don't think is particularly surprising. And a massive bull on the left flank of the painting stands rather passively. People have wondered for a long time what those two animals in particular represent, and Picasso was always reluctant to participate in that discussion. He did agree with when people would put interpretations to him, he occasionally would say, "Well, sure, that's what I meant," but then in another occasion would agree with an interpretation that was entirely contradictory. In the end, he seemed most comfortable to say that I want viewers of the painting to make their decisions about that. But nonetheless, the horse, the bull, the figures of weeping, wailing women, which were perfect for this scene of chaos that was representative of the bombing of Guernica, were also images that already mattered enormously to him. He already had painted many times images of women weeping and wailing. It was again a particular kind of Spanish La Llorona. The weeping woman is a very forceful Spanish symbol, and it's one that Picasso had already made his own.
In case you are just tuning in, this is the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back to 2002 and my interview with Russell Martin for his book Picasso's War, and we'll bring you the rest of it right after this. Closing out the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, I had not listened to this interview ever over the 24 years since I recorded it with Russell Martin, and he was quite a guest. My only interview with him, I loved this conversation. Closing it out on your public radio station, let's listen.
My guest is Russell Martin. He joins us in the Book Nook today with his book, Picasso's War, The Destruction of Guernica and the Masterpiece that Changed the World. It's been published by Putnam. Russell, there's so much in this book and so little time to talk about it. Just amazing stuff, like the way that the Germans set up their pavilion and all this kind of stuff. It's just fascinating. And we also have the Spanish obsession, apparently, with death and with blood. And I love the story about how Picasso met Dora Maar. Oh, that's a great story. And we also have that wonderful little fight that happens. Well, Picasso thought it was wonderful, between Dora Maar and his other mistress, who just happened to find Dora Maar in there while Picasso was painting the painting. That was a good one. That really showed the cruel side of Picasso.
That story, as Picasso painted, was at work on the canvas one day, the two women were in the studio at the same time, something that virtually never happened. And they exchanged very cross words, and their discussion became heated enough that they were actually kind of, you know, pulling at each other's clothes and were really on the verge of swinging punches at each other. And Picasso's response was simply to laugh in great delight. He thought it was great theater, great good fun to see these two women fighting over him, in effect. He remarked that he simply couldn't get involved because he liked them both and thought he would let them sort things out as best they could. He, as I mentioned earlier, he could be, you know, a vicious, unconscionably cruel kind of person. And I don't think there's any diminishment of his artistic might in acknowledging that psychologically and in the context of his treatment of the people around him, he was also pretty awful.
Well, that was quite a story. I think back to the fact that he let Dora Maar in there to photograph these paintings. Now, he was the kind of guy, he was a very sociable person, but he also had a side where he wanted to be totally solitary, left alone with his artwork, didn't allow people in there. I think there's a certain superstition among a lot of creative people, particularly visual artists. I think back to Jackson Pollock allowing the Life magazine photographer to photograph him painting a painting, and he seemed to go straight over the edge after that. It's almost like the Native American belief that taking your photograph steals your soul in a way.
Picasso was particularly disinterested in having company. He liked to have people visit the studio, but never while he was at work. In fact, when the canvas was completed in early June of 1937, just a day or two, more than a month after he began it, he invited a large collection of friends and colleagues from Paris. But during the creation of the painting, he much preferred to be alone. On one occasion, in addition to allowing her to photograph the canvas in progress, Dora Maar actually helped paint very small stippled black marks on the body of the horse. It's the only instance that's known of when anyone other than Picasso ever touched a given piece of artwork. Dora Maar is we have that information via Dora Maar. She delighted in being able to tell people that she had done a tiny bit of work on the canvas. But it was most unlike Picasso to allow something like that to happen, and really is evidence of the degree to which, quite understandably, he was fascinated by her at the time, very much in love with her.
My guess is Russell Martin. The book is Picasso's War. There's so much in this book, and your description of the way that the Spaniards were able to actually even get their building done in time for the exhibition, and then the other artists that displayed in the exhibition and what happened to their artwork, and how Picasso was so shrewd to preserve Guernica when it could have easily vanished into the sands of time, and then the bizarre side story about the American who was included in the exhibition. And we think now about the substance mercury and how you don't want to be anywhere near it, how it's so dangerous, and Alexander Calder actually made an artwork with it.
Yes, and it was a wonderful fountain that instead of seeing moving water, you observed moving mercury. That was in the courtyard of the Spanish pavilion, and Guernica was at its flank, and it was the first moving sculpture that Calder ever exhibited. Calder was a good friend of the Spanish painter Joan Miró, who had a wonderful big mural in the Spanish pavilion as well. Calder was a great friend of the Spanish Republic and was the only non-Spanish artist exhibited in the Spanish pavilion.
And Miró's mural was one of the things that vanished.
It, along with other sculptures by a number of important Spanish sculptors, were lost. They were returned to Spain into the care of the Republican government, and were lost in the tumult of the war, for reasons that we're all deeply grateful, of course, but that are still a bit unclear. Instead of the Spanish government had paid for the mural. Picasso had been understood completely that it was the property of the Spanish government, but instead of being sent to Spain when the pavilion closed and the World's Fair closed in October of 1937, the canvas was returned to Picasso's studio, and it's only for that singular reason that it survived. Its fate would almost certainly otherwise would have been the same of those other works of art, and it would have been lost to us forever.
General Franco never would have taken over ruling Spain without the help of the Nazis. And I loved your description of the meeting between Hitler and Franco. That was really a delicious meeting. I mean, you hate both these guys, but I really enjoyed what Franco did.
They met just over the French border. The two men had traveled. The Spanish Civil War was over, and Hitler was very desirous of Spain's willingness to formally enter the Second World War, and in particular, he was hopeful that vital natural resources in Spain would be made available to him. The Spanish army, the men in Spain who could fight on behalf of the Axis powers were virtually equally important. Franco, however, was shrewd enough that he was by no means willing to agree without a number of concessions, and made life very difficult for Hitler at a railway station meeting. And when Hitler finally decided that he could not get the agreement from Franco that he was hoping for, he summarily announced that he was leaving, that his train was leaving in moments, and told aides as he traveled back across France to Germany that he would rather have teeth pulled than have to meet with that small Spanish general another time.
He thought that he had bought Franco, didn't he?
He certainly did. Sure. I mean, yeah. there was without question there was a quid pro quo, and Hitler tried to make it very clear to him that he owed his rule of Spain to Hitler, but Franco, of course, didn't see it that way at all, and was tried to make sure that if he did enter the war, it would be on his own terms rather than Hitler's.
The book is Picasso's War. Russell Martin also does an extraordinary job of detailing the journey of this painting by Picasso, Guernica, as it traveled around trying to find a home in his native Spain. And you detail the personality of Franco and how he was this bloodthirsty, horrible person, and how Mussolini tried to actually save some people from being executed by Franco, and it didn't work. And years later, Picasso is old. Franco is old. Franco's hated Picasso for years, but he seems to be mellowing. He actually decides he wants the painting back in Spain.
It was the year that I spent in Barcelona, and it was astonishing when Franco announced via his culture minister that the painting Guernica, which had been housed in New York City since the end of the Spanish Civil War, would now be sought by the Spanish government. That Generalissimo Franco would greatly desire the painting's repatriation to Spain. It was an astonishing moment. Picasso instantly said, "No, that will not happen. The painting will not go to Spain until democratic liberties have been returned to that country." Franco let that go. He died in 1975, and in the years between then and his death, he did not make another attempt. But it was a strange and curious decision on his part to seek it out. Historians are convinced that it had something to do with Franco's increasing interest in the perception worldwide that Spain was a modern and open place, and not the backwater that it really had become.
Hmm. Well, it's really an intriguing look at some amazing art and history. The book is Picasso's War, The Destruction of Guernica and the Masterpiece That Changed the World. Russell Martin wrote it. It's just been published by Dutton. He's been my guest in the Book Nook today. And Russell, this has really been a fun book and a great conversation.
Vic, I've enjoyed it so much. Thank you.
What are you up to? What's your next book going to be about?
I'm at work on an exciting new project that takes me back to Europe, but it's one that I'm reluctant to talk about in any more detail than that. But the great good news for me is that there are a thousand wonderful stories out there.
Are you paranoid that if you tell me, I'll show up in Zurich and you'll see me writing my inferior version?
That's exactly it. So mum's the word for now.
This isn't the novel you alluded to, is it?
No, it's not. No, oh. I love writing fiction and will continue to do so. But my focal work for a good long time is going to be this kind of repertorially based creative nonfiction.
Where did you grow up in Colorado?
I grew up in far southwest Colorado, in the town of Cortez. Went to college at Colorado College, a liberal arts college in Colorado Springs, and have been a Westerner all my life, other than the time I've spent in Europe. My spouse and partner and I actually look forward to, now that our daughter's grown, to spending a good part of the year in Spain. Our research trip to Spain for Picasso's War reminded us that Spain's an extraordinary place, and reminded us, she's a writer as well, and it reminded us that that writing can be done anywhere. It's not a site specific kind of job. So our goal in the next few years is to spend a lot of time in Spain.
Well, I've always felt great pity for people that had to endure that sort of hardship to do their job. Russell, it's really been great to have you on the program.
Thanks so much, Vic. My pleasure. Take care.
If you can hold the phone, my guest has been Russell Martin. He's been my guest in the Book Nook today. The book is Picasso's War, The Destruction of Guernica, and the Masterpiece That Changed the World. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in.
Don't touch that dial. We've still got a few minutes left to tell you about what's coming up in the Book Nook tomorrow. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook, talking about Picasso's War with Russell Martin. Tomorrow, a book I absolutely loved. At 10:30 tomorrow morning, I'll be talking to Robin Yoakum, returning to the program to talk about The Last Hitman. And this is an excerpt from the book where our hitman is a young guy, and he's being interviewed by a mobster about a job with this mob. And I just love this story. Iceman Al peeled the plastic lid off the coffee cup and said, "You never asked me about what the job was, kid." "Doesn't matter what the job is," I said. "Are you sure you're up for this? It ain't no job for snowflakes. What I do, you know, can sometimes be construed as a rough business." I grew up in the Spaghetto. I can do rough." "Good, very good. Now, here's what you need to remember. Don't be thinking you're going to come in here and be some kind of gangster. The last two guys I hired for this job didn't understand that, which is why they ain't here anymore. This job is whatever I decide it's going to be every day, and it's going to be a lot of scut work. This job is all the crap that I don't have the time to do or don't want to do. There might be days when I tell you to go sit in the corner and twiddle your thumbs for 8 hours, but when I need you, the only answer I want to hear is yes. Got it?" I nodded. "Nodding ain't an answer." "Yes, sir." "Do you have a driver's license?" "Yes, sir." "Good. Now, we got a few rules around here that are not to be violated under any circumstances. Rule number one, and it's very simple, nothing, and I mean nothing, that you hear within the confines of this house is ever going to be repeated. Do you pray on our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ?" "Sometimes." "When you do, you don't even tell Jesus what's going on here. It's none of his business. If I think he needs to know something, I'll be the one to tell him." I wanted to grin, but knew better. "Rule number two, you do what I tell you, when I tell you, exactly as I tell you. Rule number three, this one is very important, so I want you to listen closely. I have a couple granddaughters who come around here sometimes to swim in the pool. They're about your age. If I catch you sniffing around either of them, I'll cut off your," censored, "and staple on your chin. Do you understand?" He had a castration theme going. In all honesty, it was very effective. "Yes, sir." "Then we understand each other. I don't ever want to have this conversation again." He reached into his pocket, pulled out a set of car keys, and tossed them to me. "I want the caddy washed inside and out and waxed." And the last hitman went on to become a hitman for the mob. And this is really a great story. It's told in flashbacks. It's very funny. It's by Robin Yoakum. And that'll be our book tomorrow morning at 10:30 in the Book Nook. Just came out. And you can listen to the Book Nook anytime you want. Just go into our archive at wyso.org. We have over 1,200 interviews archived. You could listen to 5 a day and listen all year long and never run out of stuff to listen to. I know people who do that. I know people who have insomnia. They sit up at night and my voice puts them right to sleep again. You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My name is Vic McCunis. Once again, tomorrow morning at 10:30, my guest will be Robin Yoakum talking about The Last Hitman. I absolutely love this book. It is so funny. I never thought killing people would be hilarious, but it is. That's tomorrow, right here. Thanks.